In 2008, we operated the first flight using biofuel. In 2018, the first commercial flight using SAF. And later this year, as you said, kind of the first 100% SAF flight flown across the transatlantic. And I guess the rationale for us doing it, which I should say is in partnership with a number of consortium members and the DfT here in the UK, is really to demonstrate that today's infrastructure, engines, airframes are capable of flying at 100% SAF safely for long-haul flights.
Welcome to Sustainability in the Air, the world's first podcast dedicated to sustainable aviation. Our mission is to show the many paths to net zero for an industry that is one of the hardest to decarbonize. So every week, we speak with airline, airport, travel, and technology executives to help separate the signal from the noise. Whether you're a frequent flyer, an airline executive, if you care about sustainability, or just love traveling, welcome aboard. This is a show by Simplifying, who have been helping build trust in travel for over 15 years. This season of the podcast is brought to you by Cirium, which is empowering the global aviation industry to reach a more sustainable future with the most accurate aircraft emissions data. The show is also supported by CarbonClick, leaders in managing carbon offsetting programs for top global airlines. Without further ado, here is your host, Shashank Nigam, CEO of Simplifying.
Virgin Atlantic will be the first airline to fly 100% on sustainable aviation fuel across the Atlantic this year in 2023. Holly dives deep into exactly how Virgin Atlantic is doing this and how this will lead to them ultimately getting to net zero by 2050 and all of their sustainability operations as well. So Holly, welcome to the show. We are very excited about the first 100% SAF flight that Virgin Atlantic will be operating this year across the Atlantic. That is pretty exciting because no one's done that before, at least in commercial aviation. How do you intend to do that and how did you get it? I'm curious to learn all about it.
Well, firstly, thank you ever so much for having me on today. And if I kick off with the 100% SAF flight, maybe I will just start by putting in context why we care about it, why we're doing it. And I think from an industry perspective, it is well documented that the global aviation today accounts for 2-3% of global carbon emissions. Without further action, and given that we are a hard to abate sector, by the time we reach 2050, we risk accounting for 20% of global emissions. And I think when you contrast that with the ambition that industry has set, Virgin Atlantic included, a number of our airline peers, plus IATA, plus ICAO, to get to 2050 net zero, the question then becomes, you know, how are we going to get there and what levers do we have at our disposal? And I think in that context, you know, you will know there are many industry roadmaps out there that kind of look at what levers do we have, how material do we expect them to be? But in that context, they broadly align on one thing, right? And that is the importance and the role of SAF. By the time we get to 2050, you know, we are de facto relying on sustainable aviation fuel to deliver 40% or more of the emission reductions we need to achieve as an industry. And I think when you put that in context for Virgin Atlantic, a long-haul only operator, then we too care about SAF kind of to that extent, if not more. And I think that's probably the reason why we, Virgin Atlantic, have been supporting SAF for a long time, right? We partnered early with a number of SAF suppliers, including LanzaTech. In 2008, we operated the first flight using biofuel. In 2018, the first commercial flight using SAF. And later this year, as you said, kind of the first 100% SAF flight flown across the transatlantic. And I guess the rationale for us doing it, which I should say is in partnership with a number of consortium members and the DfT here in the UK, is really to demonstrate that today's infrastructure, engines, airframes are capable of flying at 100% SAF safely for long-haul flights. And I think if we are successful in delivering that, then we're moving closer to kind of overcoming or demonstrating that the technical barriers to 100% use of SAF, you know, are achievable. And then we'll need to come back to, right, how do we get to scaled production and supply in order to meet that? So in terms of what we are doing across kind of the consortium partners that we have, which include the likes of Boeing and Rolls-Royce, so the flight will be operated later this year. on one of our 787s using Rolls-Royce engines, is really kind of all kind of efforts to the fore, right? And if I think about the steps we need to go through to kind of get to that, what will probably be a Q4 delivery, using around 45 tons of SAF or the flight itself and another 15 to 20 for the testing, really where we are in that program now is focused on the fuel testing and certification. And really that's kind of the gateway for us to move from the fuel side to the engine testing, to the airframe testing, to get us to a point of time later this year where we have the right safety and regulatory approvals to operate the flight.
Very interesting background. Correct me if I'm wrong, this has not been done in commercial aviation before, but this has been done, I think, by the US military and by the RAF as well in the UK. Are you building on some of these? Are you in touch with how this was with the parties that did this?
Yeah, and I think that's correct, right? When you look at what other operators have been doing, US military, yes, have operated short distance on 100% SAF, the same of the RAF here in the UK. I think United, right, have done a flight on single engine 100% SAF. And similarly, I think we've seen Etihad kind of do a shorter distance 100% SAF flight. So it will be the first across the transatlantic. It will be the first kind of long haul piece. But yes, others have been out there doing it. And I think one thing that we hope to benefit from in kind of doing this flight is that the RAF here in the UK have a very good relationship with Boeing. And Boeing were involved in kind of their shorter distance 100% SAF flight. And we absolutely are hoping to lean in and engage with the RAF to take some of their learnings as we kind of look to do this on a commercial scale at over a longer distance.
What is the challenge right now? Because I know currently it's 35%. I think that's the max that is legally allowed. Is it more of a regulatory barrier? Is it a technical barrier? Or is this a commercial thing for airlines just because SAF is so much more expensive? What is the barrier you're trying to cross here?
So I think the barrier we're really trying to get to is to look at and overcome the current kind of blending caps. And there are a number of different SAF pathways, right, in terms of feedstocks, production technologies, and all of those that are kind of approved to fossil equivalent standards are capped at a maximum 50% blend, some slightly lower, some none higher than 50%. Which means that what you need to do is blend your SAF today with fossil to de facto get you to a fuel property type that is compatible with current engines. Now, I think what we are looking to do with this flight is demonstrate that actually you can get to 100% SAF blend and you can get to a fuel kind of properties perspective. That means if at all, you may need some minor engine modifications to enable flight, but actually that the properties of the fuel itself, once you get through a blend and it requires you to put in, without becoming too technical about it, kind of a level of high aromatic SAF, which kind of is the piece that replicates the Jet A properties, so that actually you can move from this 50-50 blend maximum, move that dial upwards so that you can get to blends of 80, 90, 100% SAF.
I'd be very curious to see how this works. Now, when is this flight being operated? Do we have a date yet?
Date TBD, exact date to be confirmed, but it will be in Q4 this year.
Okay. And will this be a passenger flight or will this be a special flight?
That is a great question. I think when we submitted our bid, our ambition was to carry passengers on board. That still remains our ambition. But because we will operate on kind of a specific regulatory approval, both with the CAA here and likely the FAA in the US, that's something that we're going to have to come back to. I think we're hoping to work towards it. But that, of course, is conditional on getting through all the safety approvals. And that applies from our perspective, right, from a Virgin Atlantic perspective, as well as a regulatory one.
This is very interesting, because if you do not have a packed flight full of people and cargo, then the per seat footprint is going to be kind of high, isn't it?
The per seat footprint will be high, right? And I think when we look at it through that lens, and you know, that's a great question. if we're flying 100% SAF, we should all recognize that will leave residual emissions, right? There will be a residual emission footprint of probably 20-ish%. That leaves you with of course, a carbon footprint. Now, what we're doing on those residual emissions to get us to kind of a net zero flight is looking at using a removal to kind of address those residual emissions. So whilst the fewer passengers on board, the less efficient it is from a kind of commercial operating perspective, from a carbon footprinting perspective, the flight should operate at a net zero basis.
Does that mean you'll be taking care of the radiative forcing elements of the flight?
So one of the things we're looking to do with the flight, and you know, the primary focus is on the SAF and the carbon side, is actually we're working with RMI in that context to look at really the contrails piece and the interplay of SAF on contrail formation. So what we are currently doing on that piece, whilst the focus of the program at the moment is the fuel testing and certification, we are looking at doing some baselining work now so that on the flights we operate today on similar routes, we actually better understand the contrail formation interplay. And I think then what we will look to do on the flight itself is actually look and test some of those when you're using 100% SAF versus 100% fossil to see what impact does that have on contrail formation. And off the back of that, we would hope to get to a point in time, and we recognize this is a single flight on a single day at a single point in time, right? Of course. But to the extent we are able to better build our understanding of contrails in the lead up to that and take some insights from the flight itself, then our ambition is to get to a place where we're able to frame some recommendations, right, that look at, well, what is the impact of SAF around contrails? And actually, is there a way forward in terms of operationalizing how we may think about time of flight, altitude of flight, that has a meaningful impact on contrails as well as carbon?
This is very interesting because I think there are very few airlines who are doing work on contrails. I think Etihad had on their CEO and they talked about contrails. Is this now a fact that you believe in, that contrails is something you should be working actively towards reducing? Or is this still something contested and you're exploring if this is real or not from an airline perspective?
I think from an airline community perspective, and particularly from a Virgin Atlantic perspective, I think that a better understanding of contrails is something that there is mass support behind. And I think we see that in some of the work that's going on across industry, right? There's some work going on in the US with MIT and Delta, our joint venture partner. There is a focus within the context of the UK's Jet Zero Council to better understand kind of aviation's impact on contrails. So do I think we have all the answers and a firm commitment as to what the impact is and what the answer is? No. But do I think the industry are increasingly cognizant of the need to better understand and think about how we address contrails? Yes.
That makes sense. Now, back to sustainable aviation fuel and SAF. Last year, I think it was, you announced that you'd be purchasing 10 million gallons of SAF through Gevo, thanks to your partnership with Delta. Can you put that into perspective for us? What does 10 million gallons amount to in terms of percentage of your annual fuel consumption, for example?
So if I bench that to where we expect to be in 2030, right, which is where we and others in industry are talking about a 10% SAF in the fuel mix target, by the time we get to 2030, we will expect kind of 10% of our fuel from a SAF perspective in terms of volume to equate to about 50 million US gallons. So a 10 million US gallons per annum kind of offtake with Gevo and our partners Delta will account to kind of 20% of that target, but, you know, 2% really of the overall fuel mix. So still not material, but I think an important step on our journey to start building volumes towards that target.
Right. And while Gevo was the start, again, thanks to your partnership with Delta, your other commitment is with Air Company, the SAF startup. And yes. As you know, they started, you know, turning air into vodka and perfume. And then last year, they, of course, announced that they'll be turning CO2 into SAF.
Yeah.
They say that you are their launch customer. Tell us, what does this mean? What are the quantities you're looking at, especially with the perspective you just gave and, you know, the background of how this deal came about with a fresh new startup?
Yeah, of course. So I think when we look across the SAF landscape, and I think you'd probably hear many airlines talking about this, we recognize there are multiple pathways, there are multiple technologies, and there are different risks and opportunities in each of those. So when we think about how do we procure for SAF to get to 10% to 2030 and beyond, I think we're probably not alone in looking to diversify across a portfolio. Now, when it comes to Air Company in particular, we started having conversations with them last year, and I think that the reason they resonate for us is probably twofold, right? One, they are leapfrog in a sense, and that they are looking to what we call kind of this third generation power to liquid SAF. And they are a company who are startup, right? And when we started having conversations with them, I think the things that really struck us was they've almost approached it from the inverse, right? In terms of a traditional fuel supplier, they started thinking about actually kind of carbon capture and utilization in product. And they did that through actually surprisingly, or not surprisingly, but unique, certainly in my opinion, from a consumer lens. So they have their technology out there. They are testing it and they are producing kind of consumer facing products in their Air Vodka and their perfume. And I think really the two things that therefore mattered to us was in terms of this innovator and disruptor mindset for Virgin Atlantic, that's something that really resonates with us. And then secondly, this kind of unique positioning they have in being able to think about and position themselves almost with a consumer lens. And again, when I think about what Virgin Atlantic does, and I think about the hurdle we have to overcome in terms of talking within industry about SAF and its importance and how we scale versus bringing our customers on the journey with us, the partnership between us and their company, I think, positions us really quite uniquely to start tackling the problem from both ends.
You said you want to look at the landscape and hedge your bets. Does that mean Air Company and Gevo are just two of many you might be partnering with for SAF?
I think we're certainly looking across a number of producers. And I think if I think about our network footprint, right, we are a long-haul operator. 70% of our capacity is between the UK and the US. So there are natural geographies where we are looking for partnerships. You know, I mentioned earlier that we have a partnership with LanzaTech. They are looking at a project in the UK. So we are speaking to them kind of around that. But I think as we start to see a little bit more movement and certainty around kind of the production side of things, then absolutely we're looking kind of at a number of SAF suppliers.
Going back to Air Company, they use carbon capture right now.
Yeah.
That, I believe, is the most expensive way to produce SAF currently. How does this make sense commercially? How does this deal come about, for example?
Yeah, I think that's also a good question, right? And I think when you look at the challenge that the many power to liquid producers are facing, it really comes down to how quickly they can get down the cost curve. And I think when you look at the inputs into that, yes, carbon capture is one of them. I think, you know, hydrogen production through electrolysis is another. And I think we recognize that both of those, plus actually your third step of combining the two to a hydrocarbon, are all incredibly energy intensive. And I think what that does, not just for Air Company, but also for all power to liquid producers out there, is really create a dependency on how quickly we get to a position of renewable electricity available at scale and at a reasonable cost.
I'm also curious, given Air Company has not yet shipped, volumes of SAF that you expect to buy from them, how do you do a deal into the future from a company that's not able to supply right now? You know, how does that work?
Yeah, I think that's also another great question, right? And I think about when, as an airline, how do we deal with fuel today? It is commodity procurement purchase, right? And they're not long-term offtakes in the terms of what we are looking at in the context of SAF. But I think the difference, technology aside, carbon efficiency aside, is really how do we, Virgin Atlantic, and in fact, all airlines and industry collectively, play a role as a catalyst for change? And I think when you look at it through that lens, then, of course, there are companies which aren't yet at production that need kind of early mover support. And I think in that context, Air Company for me is front and center of one of the companies that I think is very well positioned, but of course not yet producing at scale, of course.
That's brilliant. I'm encouraged to see a company like Virgin Atlantic supporting a new startup like Air Company. And Virgin Atlantic, I think, has always been innovating in that space, supporting the ecosystem. This is really good to see. Going back to commercially, how SAF makes sense, you announced a corporate SAF program last year, where business travelers, or rather their employees, could contribute to the cost of paying for SAF, which I assume works under a book and claim system. Can we talk a little about that? How does that work? What's the uptake been? How has that been working for you?
Yeah, so maybe I will start just by kind of giving an overview of how our program works. And I think it starts from kind of two points of nexus to what we're doing. One, it is tied to volumes of SAF that Virgin Atlantic is either committed to or is going to commit to. So there is a nexus between kind of the physical fuel that we're taking and the travel that a corporate does with us. And I think when we look at how it works in practice, essentially, we engage with our corporate customers to say that we have built out a pretty comprehensive internal data modeling capability that will look at historic travel done, kind of some of the commercial contracts we have for the year ahead with a corporate, and kind of say, right, down to the route you travel, the aircraft you're on, the cabin you fly, we can estimate the carbon footprint of your travel. And then at the back end, we can do a true up on that to actually see what your travel was. And if you want to take action, then actually participate in kind of, again, it's two sides of a coin, right, I guess, from a corporate perspective. One is we know that corporates are increasingly sophisticated and increasingly want to take a leadership position in addressing the carbon footprint of their travel. And I think by purchasing SAF, whether that's through us or through, you know, a generic book and claim platform out there, that gives them an ability from an environmental accounting perspective to take action on their carbon footprint. So I think that's one element of it from a corporate. I guess the other element of it is coming back to this notion of industry collaboration, right? If we meaningfully want to see change, deliver action and demonstrate that we're following through on some of the commitments to get to 10% 2030, to get to net zero 2050, then actually collectively we need to be sending the right demand signals so that we can support the production and scale up of SAF. And I think from what we've seen of our corporate customers, leaning into that space, both from an advocacy and a leadership position, as well as demonstrating themselves taking action on their carbon footprint, is something that there's real appetite to do.
That's really encouraging to see. Are you able to share who are some of the big corporates that have jumped onto this program or utilizing it?
It's probably something we can't yet share, but I mean, I will say for the volumes we contracted last year, that volume we have covered off fully through our corporate SAF program. So we're now taking additional volume into the network this year, and we're now working with a number of counterparties to kind of do the same for this year. So without dropping names, I think we have seen uptake, and that's a positive step forward and positive momentum.
That is, I'm really glad to hear that, because then any additional cost you're saying is already being covered by the corporate program of purchasing SAF, if I understand you right.
Yeah, so if we think about it, for want of a better phrase, kind of the green premium of SAF versus fossil, then I think what we really see in this scenario is almost a premium share across different stakeholders. So I don't know whether you're kind of familiar with some of the SAF incentive schemes that airports are starting to think about, but Heathrow is a first mover in that context, and we participate in that scheme. So we get a level of incentive rebate back from them, which I think really helps kind of collectively spread the premium, take action, and send the right demand signals out to producers.
Right. So you've, of course, launched this program for corporate travelers. And I believe your competitor, British Airways, has launched a program with Choose, which allows customers when flying BA to offset their carbon footprint. Is Virgin Atlantic launching or has launched something similar for normal flyers like you and I?
I think we have an existing kind of offsets platform, but it is de facto a kind of third-party run-through. What we have been looking at quite seriously in the last 6 months is how do we really do two things? How do we better improve transparency of carbon footprint for passengers, not just our corporates where we have, you know, a pretty comprehensive data set, but for direct passengers who are booking with us or booking through travel agents? So that's something we are taking quite seriously. And I think, you know, if you're familiar with the UK, kind of the Civil Aviation Authority here is looking at a consultation on the moment about transparency, methodology, comparability between number of tools out there that are doing it. So certainly we're looking to get to a place where transparency is better, accountability is better, and surfacing in the book flow is something that becomes more normalized. And in terms of how do we then package up for consumers, kind of almost a bundle for action, right? Depending on their appetite for SAF and for offsets and or for removals. That's something that, you know, many across the sector are considering, and we're one of them.
Now, let me play devil's advocate for a minute. Both of these programs assume that the customer is going to pay, be it the corporate customer or the passenger who's flying individually. Why should certain travelers pay for their own SAF, thereby basically subsidizing the sustainability program of the airline and also covering the mass of passengers who won't pay because the uptake is not very high? Why not just include a charge, just like your security fee, for everyone where you see it as a cost of doing business? Is that something under consideration?
I think when we think about, are we asking, let's take corporate customers as an example, are we asking them to cross-subsidize the travel of others? I don't think really that's what the the program is intended to do, or actually does do, right? We're giving them the opportunity to take action on their carbon footprint. And we should all recognize that we're in a kind of supply constrained environment. So even if we wanted to roll out that opportunity for everyone, the volume of SAF available today, in fact, wouldn't allow it. And I think if we are looking at a world where we're thinking about or should be thinking about, and I say this collectively as an industry, a form of pass through, a form of levy, without wanting to use the word, a form of kind of quasi taxation, then I think that's a slightly different conversation to my mind. And I think your question is a valid one, right? Will the incremental cost of SAF be deemed as a cost of business and passed through to the end consumer? Of course, over time, yes. In the same way as fossil costs today are factored into our operating costs and the pricing environment, I expect to see the same. Now, do I have a view on that being kind of airline-led versus taxation? Absolutely. And many, I suspect, in the industry, I'm not a believer in the blunt tool of taxation. I'm not sure it delivers the right outcomes. I'm not sure it's tied to progress on decarbonisation. And I think, you know, it would be a bad place to be, given where we are now, to be thinking about a demand management tool that looks like a form of taxation. I think there's much greater opportunity for us collectively to start thinking about and delivering on some of the scalability we need on SAF to achieve carbon reductions before we're kind of jumping the piece and imposing taxation or thinking about kind of demand management mechanisms.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from in terms of the optics of a taxation. Nobody likes being taxed or a new tax added on. But if you look at what EasyJet did for a while, you know, 100% of the flights were carbon neutral because of the offsets they were. Or even Delta, your partner, has been doing that through COVID, where 100% of domestic US flights were completely offset without any additional cost to the customer. Isn't that better, actually, for sustainability optics than a 1 or 2% uptake that we typically get from passengers voluntarily offsetting their flights?
I think if we're talking in an offset world, then, you know, that is a fair challenge. And I guess the question then comes back for me, certainly, on how do we face into kind of almost the hierarchy of how we should tackle decarbonisation? Are we looking at optimizing and maximizing investment in sector reductions? And I think we should all be looking for ways to do that. Or are we actually sending a message to our consumers that say, don't worry, we've taken care of it, which I also think is actually something that consumers expect to see, right? They expect to see airlines demonstrating that across SAF, across carbon, across removals, across offsets, that actually we are taking action so that they don't have to. Yes. But I think that gets you to the question of, okay, how are we thinking about the carbon offsets that we're participating in? And what confidence level do we have as an airline, or does a consumer have that actually that portfolio of investment? And there's a range of price points out there, right, that we are leaning into. And I think my bias, my preference will always be, how do we think about bringing the consumers who are leaning in on a journey of in-sector reduction versus kind of a generic rollout of offsets?
Right. That's a fair one. And I'm curious to see as well how this rolls out in the next couple of years, for example, as more of these programs become mainstream. Now, we've had a very long, in-depth conversation about fuel. Let's move on from fuel now into passenger experience and, you know, just the typical flying experience for a Virgin Atlantic passenger. What are you doing in terms of in-cabin sustainability? Is it important? For example, when it comes to seat covers made of e-leather or amenity kits, I have one of the upper class amenity kits, but the bamboo toothbrush that you have, or, you know, indeed your catering. What are you doing there? And do you actually check suppliers against a sustainability criteria?
Yeah. Okay. So if I take that in a couple of parts, I think we shouldn't shy away from the fact that 70% of our carbon emission footprint comes from fleet and fuel. And that is where our focus has been. But we know, we recognize, we understand that taking action across the customer journey is actually incredibly important, not because it actually is sustainability from a sustainability perspective, kind of the right thing to do, but actually that from a consumer perspective, it's what they touch, feel, experience in flight that disproportionately affects kind of their view of an airline's sustainability credentials. So I think when we think about what are we doing on board, and in fact, what are we doing with our fleet, that is an area where we have been taking a lot of action. And before we get on to cabin, if I just talk a little bit about fleet, right? Because I think there is a lot of industry talk, and you and I've had a relatively long discussion around SAF and the role it has to play. But when we think about short-term reductions that we can achieve as an industry now that are within our control, fleet should be first and foremost in those. And I think at Virgin Atlantic, for example, we have invested heavily over the past 10 years in a fleet transformation. That gives us a 70% fleet, which is next generation. It delivers kind of 30% carbon efficiency improvements on our 350s versus the fleet they replace. And it means actually that when a consumer is looking to travel Virgin Atlantic versus Pearset, actually the fleet that we fly is a structural advantage in terms of your carbon efficiency and your footprint. So you choose to fly Virgin Atlantic across the transatlantic, and actually you may well find that your carbon emission footprint versus choosing to fly a competitor is actually already between 10 and 30% lower. And I think so the fleet you fly is obviously incredibly important, as well as the fuel you burn. Now, how that plays through to us for what we're doing in cabin from a sustainability perspective, that really comes through a lens of customer experience first, but always with sustainability in mind. And I mean, you've referenced, you know, the 339s that started entering our fleet in the back end of last year. They are our first fleet to have vegan leather in our social spaces, in upper and premium. Other things we are doing across the journey, we trialed last year, and we're rolling out further this year, kind of pre-order, pre-select across our upper and premium cabins, which actually gives the customer the opportunity to personalize their experience, right? They tailor it to actually what they would expect to see when they are flying. And from a sustainability perspective, within the scope of the trials we've done, it actually results in a 12% reduction of waste on board. And so I think it's initiatives like that. And we've done the same on plastics. You know, we have taken off 60 million items of plastic, and that almost touches everything across the journey, from the kind of plastic water bottles through to the headphones, through to our amenity kits. So I think as we innovate through the customer journey, and that will always be experience-led, we are taking every opportunity to actually think consciously about the sustainability, the supply, the procurement choices we're making to ensure that actually we're winding sustainability in to our kind of BAU decision-making. So if I think about how that plays out for us in a supply chain perspective, yes, we work quite closely with our supply chain to kind of set essentially, they're not just limited to sustainability, right? But they are supplier standards that we expect to see. And I think there's a couple of things that we are doing there, and there is absolutely more to be done around the frameworks we have, the standards that kind of we put in place as we're making procurement decisions. And then actually, how are we working more collaboratively with our supply chain to collectively make improvements?
Fantastic. This is really good to know and encouraging to know. As you know, let's move on a little bit towards the issues you face from a climate perspective in Europe. Environmentalists say that the real problem in aviation is growth, and that as a result, the industry incremental improvements don't really matter. Do you feel growth is compatible with industry's net zero goals and targets? And how do you feel about measures like a frequent flyer tax, for example?
I think if I first kind of take this point of, do incremental improvements matter? I think absolutely they do. And I don't think we should lose sight of the fact that aviation, from a fuel efficiency perspective, because of its material nature and the cost base, is an industry that is relatively, very actually, efficient. But do I think we should overlook kind of some of the incremental changes we can make, be those around airspace management, be them around fleet procurement, be them around operational efficiencies? I think everything has a role here to play, right? And everything we can do to reduce in-sector emissions is action that we should collectively be taking as an industry. I think to the question of, do I believe growth is compatible with net zero 2050? Yes. Yes, it is. If we collectively as an industry are able to demonstrate that we are taking action on decarbonisation. And I don't think that at Virgin Atlantic, and I actually don't think more broadly across industry, we would expect an unlimited licence to operate if we can't demonstrate that actually we are making progress on our decarbonisation agenda. Of course, that is something that none of us would be pushing as a palatable outcome. But do I think we should be in a position where we are foregoing growth and the benefits of aviation, be them economic, be them social, be them from a kind of globalisation perspective? I am a strong, strong advocate for the benefits that global travel and aviation brings. And I think, do we think that when, you know, there's a number of figures banded around, but quite frequently, 80% of the world's population has never flown. Do we think that growth in aviation isn't something we should be accepting because of decarbonisation? I don't think that's right, as long as we are collectively taking action and tackling decarbonisation.
That's well said. I personally believe aviation makes the world a smaller and better place too. And we just want to make sure that we do it in a way it's right for the planet as well. And it's great to see these steps you're taking in the current exact fleet that you have and the current way fuel is used. But Virgin Atlantic, of course, has invested in future technologies as well. One of them is the eVTOL company, Vertical Aerospace. Talk us through how their eVTOLs will fit in your strategy when they start flying currently in 2026.
So I think I'll probably start there where I started at the beginning. Today, Virgin Atlantic is a long-haul only airline. And I think when we look across the potential levers of decarbonisation, be that battery electric, be that hydrogen, for our traditional airline model, that is something that for us is really, you know, not within our mindset of 2050. Having said that, and I do want to emphasize this point, when we think about eVTOL, for Virgin Atlantic, that isn't something that we suggest is addressing our sustainability and our decarbonisation agenda. The two are totally separate. So when we think about eVTOL, I think we come at it from the service we offer, our focus on the consumer, and kind of the seamless journeys that we want to make available to customers who choose to fly Virgin Atlantic. And I think eVTOL offers a solution to the first and last 100 miles of the customer journey. Yes, it is zero emission flight, but I think it is that element of how we bring together kind of the connectivity to Virgin Atlantic services in a zero emission world. But it's really about the seamless nature of the journey and offering kind of a premium, sustainable and affordable mode of transport for customers who choose to fly Virgin Atlantic or in fact kind of any other airline.
What might be potential routes for these eVTOLs? Do you have that in mind already?
That's another great question. I think that when we think about how we would start with eVTOL, airport connectivity will be front and center use case for us. Absolutely it will be. But I don't think for us that stops there, and we are increasingly bullish on the regional mobility use case of eVTOL, particularly for the UK and particularly when we see kind of a London-centric transport road network and rail network. I think the opportunity for regional connectivity across the UK served by eVTOL is something that we are very excited about, alongside the opportunity for airport connectivity.
So paint a picture for me here. Can I potentially take a Vertical Aerospace eVTOL from King's Cross Station after taking a train from Edinburgh on Lumo Electric, and then taking the electric Vertical UAM over to Heathrow to board your upper class? Is that the plan?
Yes, so I think the plan will be exactly that, right? How do we tie together what are currently disparate elements of a journey to or from an airport that makes it seamless, regardless almost of where you originate in terms of your starting point? And I think, yes, when we think about use cases, how do we connect, you know, inner city London to Heathrow in a way that is efficient, seamless and premium? But I think it's also about how do we better connect regional areas of the UK to Heathrow? And actually, how do we best connect regional areas of the UK? And I think if I take an example, Oxford to Brighton, right, it can take 3 hours by train with potentially up to kind of three different changes. To my mind, that's a use case that actually on an eVTOL, the trip's more like half an hour. It's zero emission. It's closer to door to door. And I think when you start to think about it that way, then there is a network of regional intercity connectivity across the UK that can be effectively served by eVTOL.
Then let's move on from eVTOLs now to supersonic. Virgin Atlantic was also one of the early customers of Boom Supersonic. Firstly, are you still a customer? So we can talk about it.
I think from a Boom perspective, I think that, as Blake, I believe, said to you on his last podcast, that relationship kind of originated with Virgin Group. Does Virgin Atlantic itself remain excited about Boom? I can't speak for an enterprise level, but personally, the use case of supersonic and the work that Boom are doing, I am a massive fan of. And I think commercially, and there are some dependencies and there are some controversies, of course, the use case to my mind as a transatlantic carrier is one that is not unattractive.
Okay, I can totally see the commercial business case here. I actually had Blake Scholes from Boom on the podcast last season, but as you know, it's controversial and it has a lot of detractors, especially from a climate perspective. What do you see to the claim that, you know, supersonic travel is wasteful, is for the top 0.1%, especially when it comes to burning up the limited amount of SAF that we have, that we spoke about earlier?
Yeah, and if I think about the sustainability challenge that's facing Boom, actually, to my mind, I don't see it as hugely different to the sustainability challenge that is facing conventional commercial aviation, particularly as a long-haul operator, right? And I think where we need to get to is a tipping point of SAF supply, availability, price premium that actually means we get to a point where actually we're not having a conversation around, you know, which passenger segment, which country gets to, you know, use SAF over fossil. We're in a world where actually supply is at scale. We've removed the barrier. And once you remove the barrier, then I think the critique and the conversation falls away. Now, of course, the question becomes, how long will it take us to reach that tipping point? And that's a harder question, right? That's a harder question.
Fair enough. And I'm curious to see how the space unfolds, of course. Let's think really short term here. 2030, just 7 years from now, where do you see Virgin Atlantic will be? How will the flying experience be different? How much closer will you be towards your sustainability goals?
Yeah, I think when we get to 2030, and if I take it from a sustainability perspective, I expect us, I expect industry, I expect many other airlines to be judged on the progress we've made in hitting 10% SAF. Am I optimistic on our ability to get there? Absolutely. Do I think, you know, it's going to be incredibly challenging from a UK perspective, particularly when you see kind of some of the incentive environments that are developing in the US and in the EU? Of course, we have a challenge to overcome. Am I optimistic we can get there? Actually, I am. And I think I say I am because I've kind of observed for the last 4 or 5 years, the pace of alignment, the pace of change, the pace of commitment we've seen from industry is, compared to many, actually, I would say really quite exponential. And if we can follow through on that and seeding production and getting to scale, then I think, you know, there is every opportunity for us to hit 10% to 2030. And if we hit 10% to 2030, then I believe that unleashes the scale up and the investment profile that we need to actually get to 2050.
Right. I think that's a very good interim target right now. But by the way, just thinking about interim targets, is Virgin Atlantic currently undergoing a SBTI or any other third-party process to, you know, rate your own net zero plan?
Yeah, so we, as you know, we have a number of interim targets alongside our 2050 target. So that starts for us in 2026, when we're looking at kind of a unit efficiency carbon target, 2030, 10% SAF. We've got an interim target in 2040 as we build our way to 2050. Coming back to your specific question on SBTI, this is, of course, a space where many airlines rightly are looking to commit to and get verified an SBTI target. Virgin Atlantic is no different. It's something we're actively considering. I think we've kind of got a job ahead of us, right, to work through the latest aviation-specific guidance that was earmarked for summer last year. We've seen it recently come out. And I think in that context, you know, over time, we're going to see a progression. And I think if any airline, and I don't think they are now, but we're in a world of kind of measures that get us to 1.5, right? And I think if you look back, that's not necessarily the case in some of the historic SBTIs that have been set. But as we think about it at Virgin Atlantic, you know, it's 1.5. And
fantastic. Holly, I think I have a very good overview, not just what your big task is this year with the 100% SAF flight. I think it's ambitious, but also your interim targets of getting to 10% SAF by 2030, which ultimately lead to everything we spoke about around getting to net zero by 2050. Very encouraging. The last part of this interview is what I call the rapid fire round, in which we and the audience gets to know you a little bit more personally. So if you're game for it, I'm going to ask you a question and hopefully you can reply very, very, very quickly with an answer there. And we'll start with something simple. What is your favorite book?
Favorite book? I'm going to say Good to Great, Jim Collins. That is a non-negotiable read if you work at Virgin Atlantic. And I think, in fact, one of the best kind of business books out there. So I'll go with that.
I would agree. It's a classic, but I'm surprised you did not say one of Richard Branson's many books, for example.
They're also excellent.
Well said. What about your favorite movie?
I'm going to throw you a curveball on this one, and only because I hated it the first time and I have grown to love it, which I think encourages me to be more open-minded, Zoolander.
Wow, okay. I had not expected that. Sure, I'll take it. Take you for it. What about your favorite city?
favourite city of mine, probably Cape Town.
Absolutely beautiful. I remember being up on the Table Mountain and there's a microclimate with plants that don't grow anywhere else. You're absolutely right. Stunning city. What about your favourite airline? Tough one.
Yeah, for me, that's non-negotiable. That's an easy answer. And that is Virgin Atlantic.
We'll take you for it. What is something you want to learn?
There are many things I want to learn. And I think one of the things I love about working for an airline is actually the opportunity to learn is daily, right? There's just the complexity of the operation, the commercial, the sustainability, the decarbonisation. So I love that. If I think beyond kind of work, I guess I would say I'm typically British in my ability to speak languages, which is I can't. But I did at school spend quite a lot of time doing Japanese, and to pick that up again, I would love to do.
Fantastic. Learning Japanese, why not? Why not? Who do you look up to?
I think it's less of a kind of who do I look up to and more what do I look up to. And I think in that context, one of the things that I've increasingly started to appreciate is actually is value-led leadership, right? Where there is leadership based on a true value, a true vision, a true commitment. And I think fortunately for me, given where I work, and this probably kind of informs my answer on favourite airline, across Virgin Atlantic, across Virgin Group, across Delta, kind of the value-led leadership that we have is really something that I think sets us apart.
That's a good answer. Sure, I'll take that. And finally, the best advice you've received.
On this one, I'm going to go a slight curveball, and I'm not sure it's the best advice I've ever received, but it's certainly the most memorable, which is my grandpa has consistently said to me since I was the age of 10, it is not what you know, Holly, it is who you know. And I think for me, I would like to think that actually meritocracy, diversity of thought, hard work are the things that kind of frame what you do and how far you go. And even if my sphere of influence is limited to my own two children, kind of proving that wrong and proving the value of meritocracy right is something I would like to do.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Holly. Is there anything we have not spoken about that you would like to add?
Not from my side.
All right. Really enjoyed having you on, and I wish you all the best for this first flight. If passengers are allowed, I would love to be on that flight and see how that goes.
Done.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Sustainability in the Air, the world's first podcast dedicated to sustainable aviation. Awareness is the key to a green future, so please give us your support to help our sustainable aviation insights reach a wider audience. You can do this by sharing us with your network or leaving a review. For more information on how aircraft emissions data can help you reach your sustainability goals, visit Cirium from the link in the show notes. You can start a conversation with us at podcast@simplifying.com. And for more content on sustainable aviation, please visit our website, simplifying.com, and join the movement.